till last to present the king with his own gift, a longsword. Its scabbard was made of cherry wood, gold, and oiled red leather, studded with golden lions' heads. The lions had ruby eyes, she saw. The ballroom fell silent as Joffrey unsheathed the blade and thrust the sword above his head. Red and black ripples in the steel shimmered in the morning light.
"Magnificent," declared Mathis Rowan. "A sword to sing of, sire," said Lord Redwine.
"A king's sword," said Sir Kevin Lannister. King Joffrey looked as if he wanted to kill someone right then and there, he was so excited. He slashed at the air and laughed.
"A great sword must have a great name, my lords. What shall they call it?"
Sansa remembered Lion's Tooth, the sword Arya had flung into the trident, and Heart Eater, the one he'd made her kiss before the battle. She wondered if he'd want Margaery to kiss this one. The guests were shouting out names for the new blade. Joffrey dismissed a dozen before he heard one he liked.
"Widow's Wail," he cried. "Yes, it shall make many a widow, too."
He slashed again.
"And when I face my uncle Stannis, it will break his magic sword clean in two."
Joff tried a down cut, forcing Sir Balon's one to take a hasty step backward. Laughter rang through the hall at the look on Sir Balon's face.
"Have a care, your grace,"
Sir Adam Marbrunt warned the king.
"Valyrian steel is perilously sharp."
"I remember."
Joffrey brought Widow's Wail down in a savage two-handed slice onto the book that Tyrion had given him. The heavy leather cover parted at a stroke.
"Sharp, I tell you. I am no stranger to Valyrian steel."
It took him half a dozen further cuts to hack the thick tome apart, and the boy was breathless by the time he was done. Sansa could feel her husband struggling with his fury as Sir Osmond Kettleback shouted,
"I pray you, never turn that wicked edge on me, sire. See that you never give me cause, sir."
Joffrey flicked a chunk of Lives of Four Kings off the table at sword point, then slid Widow's Wail back into its scabbard.
"Your grace," Sir Garland Tyrell said, "perhaps you did not know, in all of Westeros there were but four copies of that book illuminated in Caith's own hand."
"Now there are three."
Joffrey undid his old sword belt to don his new one.
"You and Lady Sansa owe me a better present, Uncle Imp. This one is all chopped to pieces."
Tyrion was staring at his nephew with his mismatched eyes.
"Perhaps a knife, sire, to match your sword. A dagger of the same fine Valyrian steel with a dragonbone hilt, say."
Joffrey gave him a sharp look.
"You? Yes, a dagger to match my sword. Good."
He nodded.
A gold hilt with rubies in it. Dragonbone is too plain."
"As you wish, your grace."
Tyrion drank another cup of wine. He might have been all alone in Isola for all the attention he paid Sansa, but when the time came to leave for the wedding, he took her by the hand. As they were crossing the yard, Prince Oberyn of Dorne fell in beside them, his black-haired paramour on his arm. Sansa glanced at the woman curiously. She was base-born and unwed, and had borne two bastard daughters for the prince. But she did not fear to look even the queen in the eye. She had told her that this Ilaria worshipped some Lycian love goddess.
"She was almost a whore when he found her, milady," her maid confided, "and now she's near a princess."
Sansa had never been this close to the Dornish woman before.
"She's not truly beautiful," she thought, "but something about her draws the eye. I once had the great good fortune to see the Citadel's copy of Lives of Four Kings," Prince Oberyn was telling her lord husband. "The illuminations were wondrous to behold, but Caith was too kind by half to King Viserys."
Tyrion gave him a sharp look.
"Too kind? He scans Viserys shamefully, in my view. It should have been Lives of Five Kings."
The prince laughed.
Viserys hardly reigned a fortnight.
He reigned more than a year, said Tyrion.
Oberyn gave a shrug.
A year or a fortnight, what does it matter? He poisoned his own nephew to gain the throne, and then did nothing once he had it.
Baelor starved himself to death fasting, said Tyrion. His uncle served him loyally as hand, as he had served the young dragon before him. Viserys might have only reigned a year, but he ruled for 15, while Daeron warred and Baelor prayed.
He made a sour face. And if he did remove his nephew, can you blame him? Someone had to save the realm from Baelor's follies.
Sansa was shocked.
But Baelor the Blessed was a great king. He walked the Bone Way barefoot to make peace with Dawn, and rescued the Dragon Knight from a snake pit. The vipers refused to strike him because he was so pure and holy.
Prince Oberyn smiled. If you were a viper, my lady, would you want to bite a bloodless stick like Baelor the Blessed?
I'd sooner save my fangs for someone juicier.
My prince is playing with you, Lady Sansa, said the woman Ilaria Sand. The septons and singers like to say that the snakes did not bite Baelor, but the truth is very different. He was bitten 50 times and should have died from it.
If he had, Viserys would have reigned 12 years, said Tyrion, and the 7 kingdoms might have been better served. Some believe Baelor was deranged by all that vellum.
Yes, said Prince Oberyn, but I've seen no snakes in this red keep of yours. So how do you account for Joffrey?
I prefer not to. Tyrion inclined his head stiffly. If you will excuse us, our litter awaits.
The dwarf helped Sansa up inside and clambered awkwardly after her.
Close the curtains, my lady, if you'll be so good.
Must we, my lord? Sansa did not want to be shut behind the curtains. The day is so lovely.
The good people of King's Landing are like to throw dung at the litter if they see me inside it. Do us both a kindness, my lady. Close the curtains.
She did as he bid her. They sat for a time as the air grew warm and stuffy around them.
I was sorry about your book, my lord, she made herself say.
It was Joffrey's book. He might have learned a thing or two if he'd read it.
He sounded distracted. I should have known better. I should have seen a good many things.
Perhaps a dagger will please him more.
When the dwarf grimaced, his scar tightened and twisted.
The boy's hand himself a dagger, wouldn't you say?
Thankfully, Tyrion did not wait for her reply.
Joff quarrelled with your brother Rob at Winterfell. Tell me, was there ill-feeling between Bran and his grace as well?
Bran? The question confused her. Before he fell, you mean?
She had to try and think back. It was all so long ago.
Bran was a sweet boy. Everyone loved him. He and Tommen fought with wooden swords, I remember, but just for play.
Tyrion lapsed back into moody silence. Sansa heard the distant clank of chains from outside. The portcullis was being drawn up. A moment later, there was a shout, and their litter swayed into motion. Deprived of the passing scenery, she chose to stare at her folded hands, uncomfortably aware of her husband's mismatched eyes.
Why is he looking at me that way?
You loved your brother as much as I love Jaime.
Is this some Lannister trap to make me speak treason?
My brothers were traitors, and they've gone to traitors' graves. It is treason to love a traitor.
Her little husband snorted.
Rob rose in arms against his rightful king. By law, that made him a traitor. The others died too young to know what treason was.
He rubbed his nose.
Sansa, do you know what happened to Bran at Winterfell?
Bran fell. He was always climbing things, and finally he fell. We always feared he would. And Theon Greyjoy killed him. But that was later.
Theon Greyjoy, Tyrion sighed.
Your lady mother once accused me
Well, I will not burden you with the ugly details. She accused me falsely. I never harmed your brother, Bran, and I mean no harm to you.
What does he want me to say?
That is good to know, my lord. He wanted something from her, but Sansa did not know what it was. He looks like a starving child, but I have no food to give him. Why won't he leave me be?
Tyrion rubbed his guard's cabby nose yet again, an ugly habit that drew the eye to his ugly face.
You have never asked me how Rob died, or your lady mother.
I would sooner not know. It would give me bad dreams.
Then I will say no more.
That's kind of you.
Oh, yes, said Tyrion. I am the very soul of kindness. And I know about bad dreams.
The Discarded Knight. All kneel for his magnificence, his Dars O'Lorik, 14th of that noble name, King of Meereen, Scion of Gis, Octarch of the Old Empire, Master of the Scarhazadan, Consort to Dragons, and Blood of the Harpy, roared the herald. His voice echoed off the marble floor and rang amongst the pillars. Sebastian Selmy slipped a hand beneath the fold of his cloak and loosened his sword in its scabbard. No blades were allowed in the presence of the king, save those of his protectors. It seemed as though he still counted amongst that number, despite his dismissal. No one had tried to take his sword, at least. Daenerys Targaryen had preferred to hold court from a bench of polished ebony, smooth and simple, covered with the cushions that Ser Barristan had found to make her more comfortable. King Hisdar had replaced the bench with two imposing thrones of gilded wood, their tall backs carved into the shape of dragons. The king seated himself in the right-hand throne, with a golden crown upon his head and a jeweled scepter in one pale hand. The second throne remained vacant.
"The important throne," thought Ser Barristan. "No dragon chair can replace a dragon, no matter how elaborately it's carved."
To the right of the twin thrones stood Gogor the giant, a huge hulk of a man with a brutal, scarred face. To the left was the spotted cat, a leopard skin flung over one shoulder. Back of them were Bellaquo Bonebreaker and the coal-eyed Kras.
"Seasoned killers all," thought Selmy. "But it is one thing to face a foe in the pit when his coming is heralded by horns and drums, and another to find a hidden killer before he can strike."
The day was young and fresh, and yet he felt bone-tired, as if he'd fought all night. The older he got, the less sleep Ser Barristan seemed to need. As a squire, he could sleep 10 hours a night, and still be yawning when he stumbled out onto the practice yard. At 63, he found that 5 hours a night was more than enough. Last night he had scarce slept at all. His bedchamber was a small cell off the queen's apartments, originally slave quarters. His furnishings consisted of a bed, a chamber pot, a wardrobe for his clothing, even a chair should he want to sit. On a bedside table he kept a beeswax candle and a small carving of the warrior. Though he was not a pious man, the carving made him feel less alone here in this queer alien city, and it was to that he had turned in the black watches of night.
"Shield me from these doubts that gnaw at me," he had prayed, "and give me the strength to do what is right."
But neither prayer nor dawn had brought him certainty. The hall was as crowded as the old knight had ever seen it, but it was the missing faces that Barristan Selmy noted most. Missandei, Belwas, Grey Worm, Aggo and Jogo and Ricaro, Iri and Jiqui, Dario Naharis. In the shave-pate's place,
stood a fat man in a muscled breastplate and lion's mask, his heavy legs poking out beneath a skirt of leather straps. Mark Haz O'Lorick, the king's cousin, new commander of the Brazen Beasts. Selmy had already formed a healthy contempt for the man. He had known his sort in King's Landing, fawning to his superiors, harsh to his inferiors, as blind as he was boastful, and too proud by half. Scarhaz could be in the hall as well, Selmy realized. That ugly face of his concealed behind a mask. 20 brazen beasts stood between the pillars, torchlight shining off the polished brass of their masks. The shave pate could be any one of them. The hall thrummed to the sound of 100 low voices, echoing off the pillars and the marble floor. It made an ominous sound, angry. It reminded Selmy of the sound a hornet's nest might make, an instant before hornets all came boiling out. And on the faces in the crowd, he saw anger, grief, suspicion, fear. Hardly had the king's new herald called the court to order than the ugliness began. One woman began to wail about a brother who had died at Daznak Spit, another of the damage to her palanquin. A fat man tore off his bandages to show the court his burned arm, where the flesh was still raw and oozing. And when a man in a blue and gold toga began to speak of Hargaz the hero, a freeman behind him shoved him to the floor. It took 6 brazen beasts to pull them apart and drag them from the hall. Fox, hawk, seal, locust, lion, toad. Selmy wondered if the masks had meaning to the men who wore them. Did the same men wear the same masks every day, or did they choose new faces every morning? Quiet! Resnick Mo Resnick was pleading. Please! I will answer if you will only...
Is it true?
A free woman shouted.
Is our mother dead?
No, 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 Resnick screeched. Queen Daenerys will return to Meereen in her own time, in all her might and majesty. Until such time, his worship, King Hisdar, shall... Is no king of mine, a freedman yelled. Men began to shove at one another. The queen is not dead, the seneschal proclaimed. Her blood riders have been dispatched across the Skarhazidan to find her grace and return her to her loving lord and loyal subjects. Each has 10 picked riders, and each man has 3 swift horses, so they may travel fast and far. Queen Daenerys shall be found. A tall Giscari in a brocade robe spoke next, in a voice as sonorous as it was cold. King Hisdar shifted on his dragon throne, his face stony as he did his best to appear concerned but unperturbed. Once again, his seneschal gave answer. Sir Barristan let Resnack's oily words wash over him. His ears in the king's guard had taught him the trick of listening without hearing, especially useful when the speaker was intent on proving that words were truly wind. Back at the rear of the hall, he spied the Dornish princeling and his 2 companions. They should not have come. Martell does not realize his danger. Daenerys was his only friend at this court, and she is gone. He wondered how much they understood of what was being said. Even he could not always make sense of the mongrel Giscari tongue the slavers spoke, especially when they were speaking fast. Prince Quentin was listening intently, at least.
That one is his father's son.
Short and stocky, plain-faced, he seemed a decent lad, sober, sensible, dutiful, but not the sort to make a young girl's heart beat faster. And Daenerys Targaryen, whatever else she might be, was still a young girl, as she herself would claim when it pleased her to play the innocent. Like all good queens, she put her people first, else she would never have wed Hisdar Zolorek. But the girl in her still yearned for poetry, passion, and laughter. She wants fire and Dawn sent her mud. You can make a poultice out of mud to cool a fever. You could plant seeds in mud and grow a crop to feed your children. Mud would nourish you, where fire would only consume you. But fools and children and young girls would choose fire every time. Behind the prince, Sir Geras Drinkwater was whispering something to Ironwood. Sir Geras was all his prince was not, tall and lean and comely, with a swordsman's grace and a courtier's wit. Selmy did not doubt that many a Dornish maiden had run her fingers through that sun-streaked hair and kissed that teasing smile off his lips. If this one had been the prince, things might have gone elsewise, he could not help but think. But there was something a bit too pleasant about Drinkwater for his taste. False coin, the old knight thought. He had known such men before. Whatever he was whispering must have been amusing, for his big bald friend gave a sudden snort of laughter, loud enough so that the king himself turned his head toward the Dornishmen. When he saw the prince, Hisdars O'Lurek frowned. Sir Barristan did not like that frown, and when the king beckoned his cousin Margaz closer, leaned down, and whispered in his ear, he liked that even less. "I swore no oath to Dawn," Sir Barristan told himself. But Lewin Martell had been his sworn brother back in the days when the bonds between the king's guard still went deep. "I could not help Prince Lewin on the trident, but I can help his nephew now." Martell was dancing in a viper's nest, and he did not even see the snakes. His continued presence, even after Daenerys had given herself to another before the eyes of gods and men, would provoke any husband, and Quentin no longer had the queen to shield him from Hisdar's wrath. Although, the thought hit him like a slap across the face. Quentin had grown up amongst the courts of Dawn. Plots and poisons were no stranger to him. Nor was Prince Lewin his only uncle. "He is kin to the Red Viper." Daenerys had taken another for her consort, but if Hisdar died, she would be free to wed again. Could the shave-pate have been wrong? Who can say that the locusts were meant for Daenerys? It was the king's own box. What if he was meant to be the victim all along? Hisdar's death would have smashed the fragile peace. The sons of the Harpy would have resumed their murders, the Yunkishmen their war. Daenerys might have had no better choice than Quentin and his marriage pact. Sir Barristan was still wrestling with that suspicion when he heard the sound of heavy boots ascending the steep stone steps at the back of the hall. The Yunkish men had come. Three wise masters led the procession from the Yellow City, each with his own armed retinue. One slaver wore a tokar of maroon silk fringed with gold, one a striped tokar of teal and orange, the third an ornate breastplate inlaid with erotic scenes done in jet and jade and mother-of-pearl. The sellsword captain, Bloodbeard, accompanied them with a leathern sack slung across one massive shoulder, and a look of mirth and murder on his face. "No tattered prince," Selmy noted. "No brown Ben Plum." Sir Barristan eyed Bloodbeard coolly. "Give me half a reason to dance with you, and we will see who is laughing at the end." Resnick Mo Resnick wormed his way forward. "Wise masters, you honor us. His radiance King Hisdar bids welcome to his friends from Yunkai. We understand."
"Understand this."
Bloodbeard pulled a severed head from his sack and flung it at the seneschal. Resnick gave a squeak of fright and leapt aside. The head bounced past him, leaving spots of blood on the purple marble floor as it rolled, until it fetched up against the foot of King Hisdar's dragon throne. Up and down the length of the hall, brazen beasts lowered their spears. Gogor the giant lumbered forward to place himself before the king's throne, and the spotted cat and Kras moved to either side of him to form a wall. Bloodbeard laughed.
"He's dead! He won't bite!"
Gingerly, so gingerly, the seneschal approached the head, lifted it delicately by the hair.
"Admiral Grolio!"
Sir Barristan glanced toward the throne. He had served so many kings, he could not help but imagine how they might have reacted to this provocation. Ares would have flinched away in horror, likely cutting himself on the barbs of the Iron Throne, then shrieked at his swordsman to cut the Yunkishman to pieces. Robert would have shouted for his hammer to repay Bloodbeard in kind. Even Jaehaerys, reckoned weak by many, would have ordered the arrest of Bloodbeard and the Yunkish slavers. Hisdar sat frozen, a man transfixed. Resnick set the head on a satin pillow at the king's feet, then scampered away, his mouth twisted up in a moue of distaste. Sir Barristan could smell the seneschal's heavy floral perfume from several yards away. The dead man stared up reproachfully. His beard was brown with caked blood, but a trickle of red still leaked from his neck. From the look of him, it had taken more than one blow to part his head from his body. In the back of the hall, petitioners began to slip away. One of the brazen beasts ripped off his brass hawk's mask and began to spew up his breakfast. Barristan Selmy was no stranger to severed heads. This one, though, he had crossed half the world with the old seafarer, from Pentos to Karth and back again to Astapor. Grolio was a good man. He did not deserve this end. All he ever wanted was to go home. The knight tensed, waiting.
"This," King Hisdar said at last, "this is not. We are not pleased. This, what is the meaning of this? This?"
The slaver in the maroon toga produced a parchment.
"I have the honour to bear this message from the Council of Masters."
He unrolled the scroll.
"It is here written. Seven entered Meereen to sign the peace accords and witness the celebratory games at the pit of Dasnek. As surety for their safety, seven hostages were tendered us. The Yellow City mourns its noble son, Yerkaz Zoyunsek, who perished cruelly whilst a guest of Meereen. Blood must pay for blood."
Grolio had a wife back in Pentos. Children, grandchildren. Why him, of all the hostages? Jogo, Hero, and Dario Naharis all commanded fighting men, but Grolio had been an admiral without a fleet.
Did they draw straws, or did they think Grolio the least valuable to us, the least likely to provoke reprisal?
The knight asked himself, but it was easier to pose the question than to answer it.
"I have no skill at unravelling such knots." "Your Grace," Sir Barristan called out, "if it please you to recall, the noble Yerkaz died by happenstance. He stumbled on the steps as he tried to flee the dragon, and was crushed beneath the feet of his own slaves and companions. That, or his heart burst in terror. He was old."
"Who is this who speaks without the king's leave?"
asked the Yunkish lord in the striped toga, a small man with a receding chin and teeth too big for his mouth. He reminded Selmy of a rabbit.
"Must the lords of Yunkai attend to the natterings of guards?"
He shook the pearls that fringed his toga. Hisdar Zolaric could not seem to look away from the head. Only when Resnick whispered something in his ear did he finally bestir himself.
"Yerkaz Zoyunsek was your supreme commander," he said. "Which of you speaks for Yunkai now?"
"All of us," said the rabbit. "The Council of Masters."
King Hisdar found some steel.
Then all of you bear the responsibility for this breach of our peace.
The Yunkishman in the breastplate gave answer. Our peace has not been breached. Blood pays for blood, a life for a life. To show our good faith, we return 3 of your hostages.
The iron ranks behind him parted. 3 Myrinese were ushered forward, clutching at their tokars, 2 women and a man.
Sister,
said Hisdar Zolorek stiffly.
Cousins,
he gestured at the bleeding head.
Remove that from our sight.
The admiral was a man of the sea, Sir Barristan reminded him.
Mayhaps your magnificence might ask the Yunkai to return his body to us, so we may bury him beneath the waves.
The rabbit-toothed lord waved a hand.
If it please your radiance, this shall be done, a sign of our respect.
Resnick Mo Resnick cleared his throat noisily.
Meaning no offence, yet it seems to me that her worship, Queen Daenerys, gave you 7 hostages. The other 3...
The others shall remain our guests, announced the Yunkish lord in the breastplate, until the dragons have been destroyed.
A hush fell across the hall. Then came the murmurs and the mutters, whispered curses, whispered prayers, the hornets stirring in their hive.
The dragons, said King Hisdar,
are monsters, as all men saw in Daznak's peak. No true peace is possible whilst they live.
Resnak replied,
Her Magnificence, Queen Daenerys, is mother of dragons. Only she can.
Bloodbeard's scorn cut him off.
She is gone, burned and devoured. Weeds grow through her broken skull.
A roar greeted those words. Some began to shout and curse. Others stamped their feet and whistled their approval. It took the brazen beasts, pounding the butts of their spears against the floor, before the hall quieted again. Sir Barristan never once took his eyes off Bloodbeard.
He came to sack a city, and Hisdar's peace has cheated him of his plunder. He will do whatever he must to start the bloodshed.
Hisdar Zolorek rose slowly from his dragon throne.
I must consult my council. This court is done. All kneel for his magnificence, Hisdar Zolorek, 14th of that ancient name, King of Meereen, Scion of Gis, Uktark of the old empire, master of the Skarhazidan, consort to dragons and blood of the harpy.
The herald shouted. Brazen beasts swung out amongst the pillars to form a line. Then began a slow advance in lockstep, ushering the petitioners from the hall. The Dornishman did not have as far to go as most. As befit his rank and station, Quentin Martell had been given quarters within the Great Pyramid, 2 levels down, a handsome suite of rooms with its own privy and walled terrace. Perhaps that was why he and his companions lingered, waiting until the press had lessened before beginning to make their way toward the steps. Sir Barristan watched them, thoughtful.
What would Daenerys want? He asked himself. He thought he knew.
The old knight strode across the hall, his long white cloak rippling behind him. He caught the Dornishman at the top of the steps.
Your father's court was never half so lively, he heard Drinkwater japing.
Prince Quentin, Selmy called, might I beg a word?
Quentin Martell turned.
Sir Barristan, of course. My chambers are 1 level down.
No.
It is not my place to counsel you, Prince Quentin, but if I were you, I would not return to my chambers. You and your friends should go down the steps and leave.
Prince Quentin stared.
Leave the pyramid. Leave the city. Return to Dorne.
The Dornishman exchanged a look.
Our arms and armor are back in our apartments, said Garrus Drinkwater, not to mention most of the coin that we have left. Swords can be replaced, said Sir Barristan. I can provide you with coin enough for passage back to Dawn. Prince Quentin, the king made note of you today. He frowned. Gerrus Drinkwater laughed. Should we be frightened of Hisdar Zolorek? You saw him just now. He quailed before the Yunkishmen. They sent him ahead, and he did nothing.
Quentin Martell nodded in agreement.
A prince does well to think before he acts. This king, I do not know what to think of him. The queen warned me against him as well. True, but she warned you.
Selmy frowned.
Why are you still here?
Prince Quentin flushed.
The marriage pact was made by two dead men, and contained not a word about the queen or you. It promised your sister's hand to the queen's brother, another dead man. It has no force. Until you turned up here, Her Grace was ignorant of its existence. Your father keeps his secrets well, Prince Quentin. Too well, I fear. If the queen had known of this pact in Carth, she might never have turned aside for Slaver's Bay. But you came too late. I have no wish to salt your wounds, but Her Grace has a new husband and an old paramour, and seems to prefer the both of them to you. Anger flashed in the prince's dark eyes. This Gascari lordling is no fit consort for the Queen of the Seven Kingdoms. That is not for you to judge, Sir Barristan paused, wondering if he had said too much already. No, tell him the rest of it. That day at Dasnik's pit, some of the food in the royal box was poisoned. It was only chance that strong Belwars ate it all. The Blue Graces say that only his size and freakish strength have saved him. But it was a near thing. He may yet die.
The shock was plain on Prince Quentin's face.
Poison? Meant for Daenerys? Her or Hisdar? Perhaps both. The box was his, though. His Grace made all the arrangements. If the poison was his doing, well, he will need a scapegoat. Who better than a rival from a distant land who has no friends at this court? Who better than a suitor the queen spurned?
Quentin Martell went pale.
Me? I would never... You cannot think I had any part in any...
That was the truth, or he is a master mummer.
Others might, said Sir Barristan. The Red Viper was your uncle, and you have good reason to want King Hisdar dead.
So do others, suggested Gerrus Drinkwater. Naharis, for one, the queen's...
Paramour, Sir Barristan finished, before the Dornish knight could say anything that might besmirch the queen's honour. That is what you call them, down in Dawn, is it not?
He did not wait for a reply.
Prince Lewin was my sworn brother. In those days there were few secrets amongst the king's guard. I know he kept a paramour. He did not feel there was any shame in that.
No, said Quentin, red-faced,
but Dario would kill his Dar in a heartbeat if he dared,
Sir Barristan went on.
But not with poison, never. And Dario was not there in any case. Hisdar would be pleased to blame him for the locusts all the same. But the king may yet have need of the storm crows, and he will lose them if he appears complicit in the death of their captain. No, my prince, if his grace needs a poisoner, he will look to you.
He had said all that he could safely say. In a few more days, if the gods smiled on them, Hisdar Zolorek would no longer rule Meereen. But no good would be served by having Prince Quentin caught up in the bloodbath that was coming.
If you must remain in Meereen, you would do well to stay away from court, and hope Hisdar forgets you,
Sir Barristan finished.
But a ship for Valantis would be wiser, my prince. Whatever course you choose, I wish you well.
Before he had gone three steps, Quentin Martell called out to him.
Barristan the Bold, they call you.
Some do, Selmy had won that name when he was 10 years old, a new-made squire, yet so vain and proud and foolish that he got it in his head that he could joust with tried and proven knights. So he'd borrowed a war-horse and some plate from Lord Dondarrion's armoury, and entered the lists at Blackhaven as a mystery knight. Even the herald laughed. My arms were so thin that when I lowered my lance, it was all I could do to keep the point from furrowing the ground. Lord Dondarrion would have been within his rights to pull him off the horse and spank him, but the Prince of Dragonflies had taken pity on the addle-pated boy in the ill-fitting armour and accorded him the respect of taking up his challenge. One course was all that it required. Afterwards Prince Duncan helped him to his feet and removed his helm. A boy! He had proclaimed to the crowd. A bold boy!
53 years ago, how many men are still alive who were there at Blackhaven? What name do you think they will give me should I return to Dorne without Daenerys? Prince Quentin asked. Quentin the Cautious, Quentin the Craven, Quentin the Quail. The prince who came too late, the old knight thought. But if a knight of the King's Guard learns nothing else, he learns to guard his tongue. Quentin the Wise, he suggested, and hoped that it was true.
Tyrion. Motionless as a gargoyle, Tyrion Lannister hunched on one knee atop a merlin. Beyond the Mudgate and the desolation that had once been the fish market and wharves, the river itself seemed to have taken fire. Half of Stannis' fleet was ablaze, along with most of Joffrey's. The kiss of wildfire turned proud ships into funeral pyres and men into living torches. The air was full of smoke and arrows and screams. Downstream, commoners and high-born captains alike could see the hot green death swirling toward their rafts and carracks and ferries, borne on the current of the Blackwater. The long white oars of the Moorish galleys flashed like the legs of maddened centipedes as they fought to come about, but it was no good. The centipedes had no place to run. A dozen great fires raged under the city walls, where casks of burning pitch had exploded, but the wildfire reduced them to no more than candles in a burning house, their orange and scarlet pennons fluttering insignificantly against the jade holocaust. The low clouds caught the colour of the burning river and roofed the sky in shades of shifting green, eerily beautiful. A terrible beauty, like dragon fire. Tyrion wondered if Aegon the Conqueror had felt like this as he flew over his field of fire. The furnace wind lifted his crimson cloak and beat at his bare face, as he could not turn away. He was dimly aware of the gold cloaks cheering from the hoardings. He had no voice to join them. It was a half victory. It will not be enough. He saw another of the hulks, his stuff full of King Aerys' fickle fruits, engulfed by the hungry flames. A fountain of burning jade rose from the river, the blast so bright he had to shield his eyes. Plumes of fire 30 and 40 feet high danced upon the waters, crackling and hissing. For a few moments they washed out the screams. There were hundreds in the water, drowning, or burning, or doing a little of both. "Do you hear them shrieking, Stannis? Do you see them burning? This is your work as much as mine." Somewhere in that seething mass of men, south of the Blackwater, Stannis was watching too, Tyrion knew. He'd never had his brother Robert's thirst for battle. He would command from the rear, from the reserve, much as Lord Tywin Lannister was wont to do. Like as not, he was sitting on a war horse right now, clad in bright armour, his crown upon his head. "A crown of red gold," Varys says. "Its points fashioned in the shape of flames." "My ships!" Joffrey's voice cracked as he shouted up from the wall walk, where he huddled with his guards behind the ramparts. the golden circlet of kingship adorned his battle helm.
"My Kingslander's burning. Queen Cersei, loyal man, look, that sea flower there."
He pointed with his new sword out where the green flames were licking at Seaflower's golden hull and creeping up her oars. Her captain had turned her upriver, but not quickly enough to evade the wildfire. She was doomed, Tyri knew.
There was no other way. If we had not come forth to meet them, Stannis would have sensed the trap.
An arrow could be aimed, and a spear, even a stone from a catapult. But wildfire had a will of its own. Once loosed, it was beyond the control of mere men.
"It could not be helped," he told his nephew. "Our fleet was doomed in any case."
Even from atop the Merlon, he had been too short to see over the ramparts, so it had them boost him up. The flames and smoke and chaos of battle made it impossible for Tyrion to see what was happening downriver under the castle. But he had seen it 1,000 times in his mind's eye. Bronn would have whipped the oxen into motion the moment Stannis' flagship passed under the Red Keep. The chain was ponderous heavy, and the great winches turned but slowly, creaking and rumbling. The whole of the usurper's fleet would have passed by the time the first glimmer of metal could be seen beneath the water. The Lynx would emerge dripping wet, some glistening with mud, link by link by link, until the whole great chain stretched taut. King Stannis had rowed his fleet up the Blackwater, but he would not row out again. Even so, some were getting away. A river's current was a tricky thing, and the wildfire was not spreading as evenly as he had hoped. The main channel was all aflame, but a good many of the mermen had made for the south bank and looked to escape unscathed, and at least 8 ships had landed under the city walls.
"Landed or wrecked, but it comes to the same thing. They've put men ashore. Worse, a good part of the south wing of the enemy's first 2 battle lines had been well upstream of the Inferno when the hulks went up. Stannis would be left with 30 or 40 galleys, at a guess, more than enough to bring his whole host across, once they had regained their courage. That might take a bit of time. Even the bravest would be dismayed after watching 1,000 or so of his fellows consumed by wildfire. Halen said that sometimes the substance burned so hot that flesh melted like tallow. Yet even so, Tyrion had no illusions where his own men were concerned. If the battle looks to be going sour, they'll break, and they'll break bad. Jaslyn Bywater had warned him. So the only way to win was to make certain the battle stayed sweet start to finish. He could see dark shapes moving through the charred ruins of the riverfront wharfs. Time for another sortie, he thought. Men were never so vulnerable as when they first staggered ashore. He must not give the foe time to form up on the north bank. He scrambled down off the Merlin.
"Tell Lord Jaslyn we've got enemy on the river front," he said to one of the runners Bywater had assigned to him. To another he said, "Bring my compliments to Sir Arnold and ask him to swing the hawse 30 degrees west. The angle would allow them to throw further, if not as far out into the water."
"Mother promised I could have the hawse," Joffrey said. Tyrion was annoyed to see that the king had lifted the visor of his helm again. Doubtless the boy was cooking inside all that heavy steel, but the last thing he needed was some stray arrow punching through his nephew's eye. He clanged the visor shut.
"Keep that closed, Your Grace. Your sweet person is precious to us all. And you don't want to spoil that pretty face either. The hawse are yours."
It was as good a time as any. Flinging more fireparts down onto burning ships seemed pointless. Joff had the antler men trussed up naked in the square below, antlers nailed to their heads. When they had been brought before the Iron Throne for justice, he had promised to send them to Stannis. A man was not as heavy as a boulder or a cask of burning pitch, and could be thrown a deal farther. Some of the gold cloaks had been wagering on whether the traitors would fly all the way across the Blackwater. "Be quick about it, Your Grace," he told Joffrey. "We'll want the trebuchets, throwing stones again soon enough, even while fire does not burn forever." Joffrey hurried off, happy, escorted by Sir Meron. But Tyrion caught Sir Osmond by the wrist before he could follow. "Whatever happens, keep him safe, and keep him there. Is that understood?"
"As you command," Sir Osmond smiled amiably.
Tyrion had warned Trant and Kettleblack what would happen to them should any harm come to the king, and Joffrey had a dozen veteran gold cloaks waiting at the foot of the steps.
"I'm protecting your wretched bastard as well as I can, Cersei," he thought bitterly. "See you do the same for Alla Yaya."
No sooner was Joff off than a runner came panting up the steps.
"My lord, hurry!"
He threw himself to one knee. "They've landed men on the tourney grounds. Hundreds. They're bringing a ram up to the king's gate." Tyrion cursed and made for the steps with a rolling waddle. Podrick Payne waited below with their horses. They galloped off down River Row, Pod and Sir Mandon Moore coming hard behind. The shuttered houses were steeped in green shadow, but there was no traffic to get in their way. Tyrion had commanded that the streets be kept clear so the defenders could move quickly from one gate to the next. Even so, by the time they reached the king's gate, he could hear a booming crash of wood on wood that told him the battering ram had been brought into play. The groaning of the great hinges sounded like the moans of a dying giant. The gatehouse square was littered with the wounded, but he saw lines of horses as well, not all of them hurt, and sellswords and gold cloaks enough to form a strong column. "Form up!" he shouted as he leapt to the ground. The gate moved under the impact of another blow. "Who commands here? You're going out!"
"No!"
A shadow detached itself from the shadow of the wall to become a tall man in dark grey armour. Sandor Clegane wrenched off his helm with both hands and let it fall to the ground. The steel was scorched and dented. The left ear of the snarling hound sheared off. A gash above one eye had sent a wash of blood down across the hound's old burn scars, masking half his face.
"Yes," Tyrion faced him. Clegane's breath came ragged. "Bugger that, and you."
A sellsword stepped up beside him.
"We've been out 3 times. Half our men are killed or hurt. Wildfire bursting all around us. Horses screaming like men, and men like horses. Do you think we hired you to fight in a tourney? Shall I bring you a nice iced milk and a bowl of raspberries? No? Then get on your fucking horse. You too, dog."
The blood on Clegane's face glistened red, but his eyes showed white. He drew his longsword.
"He is afraid," Tyrion realized, shocked. "The hound is frightened."
He tried to explain their need.
"They've taken a ram to the gate. You can hear them. We need to disperse them."
"Open the gates. When they rush inside, surround them and kill them."
The hound thrust the point of his longsword into the ground and leaned upon the pummel, swaying.
"I've lost half my men. Horse as well. I'm not taking more into that fire."
Sir Mandon Moore moved to Tyrion's side, immaculate in his enameled white plate.
"The king's hand commands you. Bugger the king's hand."
Where the hound's face was not sticky with blood, it was pale as milk.
"Someone, bring me a drink."
A gold cloak officer handed him a cup. Clegane took a swallow, spit it out, flung the cup away.
"Water? Fuck your water! Bring me wine!"
"He is dead on his feet." Tyrion could see it now. "The wound. The fire. He's done. I need to find someone else. But who?
Sir Mandon?"
He looked at the men and knew it would not do. Clegane's fear had shaken them. Without a leader, they would refuse as well. And Sir Mandon? "A dangerous man," Jamie said.
"Yes.
but not a man other men would follow. In the distance, Tyrion heard another great crash. Above the walls, the darkening sky was awash with sheets of green and orange light. How long could the gate hold? This is madness, he thought, but sooner madness than defeat. Defeat is death and shame. Very well, I'll lead the sortie. If he thought that would shame the hound back to valor, he was wrong. Clegane only laughed. You? Tyrion could see the disbelief on their faces. Me. Sir Mandan, you'll bear the king's banner. Pod, my helm. The boy ran to obey. The hound leaned on that notched and blood-streaked sword and looked at him with those wide, white eyes. Sir Mandan helped Tyrion mount up again. Form up, he shouted. His big red stallion wore crinet and chamfron. Crimson silk draped his hindquarters over a coat of mail. The high saddle was gilded. Podrick Payne handed up helm and shield, heavy oak emblazoned with a golden hand on red, surrounded by small golden lions. He walked his horse in a circle, looking at the little force of men. Only a handful had responded to his command, no more than 20. They sat their horses with eyes as white as the hound's. He looked contemptuously at the others, the knights and sellswords who had ridden with Clegane. They say I'm half a man, he said. What does that make the lot of you? That shamed them well enough. A knight mounted, helmetless, and rode to join the others. A pair of sellswords followed, then more. The king's gate shuddered again. In a few moments, the size of Tyrion's command had doubled. He had them trapped. If I fight, they must do the same, or they are less than dwarfs. You won't hear me shout out Joffrey's name, he told them. You won't hear me yell for Casterly Rock either. This is your city Stannis means to sack, and that's your gate he's bringing down. So come with me and kill the son of a bitch. Tyrion unsheathed his axe, wheeled the stallion around, and trotted toward the sally port. He thought they were following, but never dared to look.
John.
Are you well, Snow? Lord Mormont asked, scowling.
Well,
his raven squawked.
Well.
I am, my lord, John lied. Loudly, as if that could make it true. And you? Mormont frowned.
A dead man tried to kill me. How well could I be?
He scratched onto his chin. His shaggy grey beard had been singed in the fire, and he'd hacked it off. The pale stubble of his new whiskers made him look old, disreputable, and grumpy.
You do not look well. How's your hand?
Healing. John flexed his bandaged fingers to show him. He had burned himself more badly than he knew, throwing the flaming drapes, and his right hand was swathed in silk halfway to the elbow. At the time he'd felt nothing. The agony had come after. His cracked red skin oozed fluid, and fearsome blood blisters rose between his fingers, big as roaches. The maester says I'll have scars, but otherwise the hand should be as good as it was before.
A scarred hand is nothing. On the wall you'll be wearing gloves, often as not.
As you say, my lord. It was not the thought of scars that troubled John. It was the rest of it. Maester Aemon had given him milk of the poppy, yet even so the pain had been hideous. At first it had felt as if his hand was still aflame, burning day and night. Only plunging it into basins of snow and shaved ice gave any relief at all. John thanked the gods that no one but Ghost saw him writhing on his bed, whimpering from the pain. And when at last he did sleep, he dreamt, and that was even worse. In the dream, the corpse he fought had blue eyes, black hands, and his father's face. But he dared not tell Mormont then.
Dywin and Hake returned last night, the old bear said. They found no sign of your uncle,
no more than the others did. I know. John had dragged himself to the common hall to sup with his friends, and the failure of the ranger's search—